That's give to WBAI.org online. All right, enough dilly-dallying. Let's go into the next program, which that happens to be Off the Hook, and it's 7 p.m. here at WBAI New York and WBAI.org online.
Customer's request, the line you are using has been toll restricted. Only local calls will be completed.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this delightful Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Over here.
And over in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex. Alex, you're very low. Every
How
week, Alex.
That?
Every
week.
It's a little low still. Can you turn up your volume?
Just any better?
No, it sounds like you're very far away.
Very far away.
Okay, that seems a little better now.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it a new setup every week, Alex? Is you buying new microphones and?
Pretty much. All actually, right. This is a slightly new setup today. So.
Well. The old setups are fine. Programming note, we will be off the air next week and the week after. So this is our last show for the next 3 weeks. So enjoy it while you can, because we're going to be doing other things, as you may well know. But there's plenty going on right now. Gosh, I don't even know where to begin. It's the eve of July 4th. Maybe it's the last July 4th. I don't. Well, it won't be the last July 4th. It might be the last Independence Day. I don't know. Any thoughts, Alex, on the latest rulings from on high that have pretty much changed the way this country is governed forever?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. disappointment, I think. And is this any better? Are my levels any better, by the way?
Well, you're leaning way up close to the screen there, and I see that you're very close. So I think if it gets a little bit higher, it might be good, but this is sufficient.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on here. But, and I guess the same could be said for the Supreme Court. I mean, the Trump immunity ruling was really interesting and disappointing in many, many ways. Obviously, the D.C. Circuit seemed to have thought this was a nothing issue, issued its per curiam opinion, essentially, meaning for the court. And it was pretty tight, but yet the Supreme Court decided to grant certiorari to that particular case and issue this opinion from a few days ago. And what they did was bifurcate the official and unofficial acts of Trump during that time, and had then claimed that, well, we don't necessarily know what is an official act and what's an unofficial act.
Can I just break in? Bifurcate is not a word that most of our listeners use in everyday conversation. It certainly isn't one I use. I have no idea what it means. So please, talk down to us, regular people.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I can use fewer syllables if you'd like, but that means it split it into two, right? So, the trick is in the by, the two is in that one. But I think WBAI listeners are very smart, as a matter of fact. I would imagine that most of them have a better vocabulary than I do. But
Not about smartness. It's about lingo. It's about, jargon. It's about using particular words in your particular field. In your case, you're a leading attorney in this nation, perhaps beyond. And you're the one that's going to explain just what the hell's going on in this country of ours.
Well, so what they did was they split this into two issues, right? They said, well, for official acts, the president is going to be immune from both criminal and civil liability. Up until this point, we'd only really talked about civil liability in many of these cases. And so this was a totally new issue for the court to talk about and to opine on. And if you're going to have any kind of criminal liability for the sovereign here, for the executive branch, the president of the United States, what the Supreme Court said was, well, we have to figure out which of his acts on January 6th were official acts and which were unofficial acts. Was it an official act when he was exhorting masses of people to go down to the Capitol and smash it up and break in to try to, quote-unquote, stop the steal? Or was it an official act or an unofficial act when he was speaking with the attorney general about various things? So all of these are issues. I think, quite frankly, they're mixed questions of law and fact. And those are the most difficult questions that a court has to answer. Because if it was just a question of a fact, well, then you could have a judge or a jury decide the fact. Remember, juries decide factual issues in the United States. They don't touch legal issues. So if this was purely an issue of law, a judge could decide it, and the Supreme Court itself could have decided it. So they must be seeing this as something that requires the record to be developed below, and by making it something that requires the factual development of a record to determine whether or not something is an official or unofficial act, what they have done with that ruling is kick the can far down the road, such that Trump really has no chance whatsoever of facing any kind of criminal trial before November for what happened on January 6th. Now, if we operate under the assumption that if he doesn't face any kind of criminal consequences before November, or let's say January of 2025, when he may very well, again, scarily, become the president of the United States, well, then at that point, he can probably exert some kind of undue influence on the Justice Department to drop those charges against himself. So we're in this really bizarre, horrible situation where what used to be considered the bulwark of our republic, the Supreme Court and the federal courts of the United States, are now playing partisan politics, helping a political candidate kick a criminal trial down the road so that he can then exert influence on the Department of Justice potentially to drop criminal charges against him. I mean, this is what I think it feels like to be part of an empire in decline.
Well, much of the analysis that I've been hearing over the past couple of days points to, you know, at first it didn't sound so bad. Official acts, unofficial acts. Okay, you know, it's easy enough to define that. But apparently, simply defining something as an unofficial act, saying, no, Mr. President, that's not an official act. You committed a crime, therefore you'll be held liable for that. From what I'm hearing, that won't be possible. It won't be possible to define something as unofficial if that person in power says it's official, because maybe I'm getting this wrong, but part of his privilege as president is to be able to define what is official and what is not. Is that, would you say that's accurate?
I think so. I think he can. I think the executive can characterize whatever the executive wants as official or unofficial, but it would be up to some kind of fact finder to make sure that that would be a reasonable characterization. Right? I mean, is jaywalking an official act or an unofficial act? I mean, we don't necessarily know, right? I mean, it depends on where you're going, right? Were you running to rush into a fire to save somebody in a burning building while you are acting in the capacity of a firefighter, or were you just crossing the street against the crosswalk? I mean, it's like all these things I think are very factual, factually dependent.
But this fact finder would be appointed by the king, and I'm sorry, I'm doing it already, by the president, and he would basically have the final say. I'm just, the way, I mean, I'm looking at Justice Sonia Sotomayor's words, and they are chilling. If you have not read those words, please do. Because she is saying, and she is a justice on the Supreme Court who has been there for quite some time, that the president now has the power, or you know, under this will have the power to use SEAL Team 6 to kill his political opponents and get away with it. And that's not some pundit saying that. That's a justice of the Supreme Court. There was a headline in The Nation the other day saying that the president now can officially assassinate you. You know, and we should keep in mind, you know, people on the left, people on the right, people for Trump, people for Biden, people for whoever, everybody should be concerned by something like this, because Trump's not in power now. Biden's in power now. So does that mean that he can take out Trump and get away with it? He certainly shouldn't be able to do that. But according to what I'm hearing from the Supreme Court, yeah, you know, official act. Now that is something that he is able to get away with. What do you do when the Supreme Court has lost its mind collectively? We don't seem to have any system in place to deal with this.
Well, I think we do. I think we do have a system in place to deal with this. And it was designed in the 18th century. It's called the Constitution and the Separation of Powers. The problem is it's failing us now. And it's failing us because of the tribal nature of this type of politics. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Emmanuel, and I think it was an erroneous assumption that, you know, well, the king who's going to appoint this king appointed person is going to become the fact finder, determine whether or not, something is an official or unofficial act. But if these are issues of fact, it could be done by a jury. Right? That could be, you know, up to a jury to find that fact, or it could be a judge. It could be a mixed question of law and fact, like I had mentioned. But the whole system of federal courts were designed to prevent and protect against this very level of political partiality by virtue of federal judges being insulated from the political process because they have lifetime appointments. And that doesn't seem to matter anymore, because judges seem to be just as influenced by partisan politics these days as anything else. And it's a very, very scary situation I think we find ourselves in, because during the first term of Trump, so scary even to mention this, but he packed the federal courts, the federal district courts, the trial level courts with a massive number of his appointees. He also packed the Supreme Court, and we see how that's working out. And none of this is supposed to happen by the design of the founders of this nation. We're talking about, you know, this I think really critical issue of how a system works. And people may be wondering, well, how does this relate to hacking, right? Well, because the framers, the founding fathers, were trying to design a system that could not be vulnerable to this type of attack. Yet here we are in the 21st century, and it is. The whole reason why federal judges are appointed for a lifetime appointment is to make sure that they are not influenced, you know, by the Republicans, by the Democrats, by the Whigs, by whoever it was or whoever it will be coming into power.
You know, it's an apt comparison because, this is a system that has been ignoring updates now for 200 years. And it is woefully in need of some upgrades, some hardware replacement, a lot. And if you leave a computer system running, you know, without doing anything to maintain it, without saying, is this still relevant today? Can I do better? Think of the kind of system you're going to have. You're going to have something that's awfully slow, clunky, and does not serve your interests at all.
I think it's hilarious when we think about the Constitution not having received some kind of update for so long. But I think part of the reason why the system that was designed so well in the 18th century is beginning to fail is because of technology. And it's because of the very fact that social media propels a judge's decisions way beyond the borders of the jurisdictional limitations of whatever that federal district court is at the moment a decision issues. And a federal judge and his clerks nowadays are very often the subject of derision and mocking and harassment and intimidation. And there's no escaping any of that now because of the proliferation of social media. So a judge, I think, is going to feel more beholden to the will of the people, to the will of the majority, and to the will of the political party that put him or her into office in the first place than they ever could have imagined in the 18th century. And so I think we lose that type. That it was that insularity of the federal judiciary that made it the bulwark of this particular type of the republic. But now there's these new attacks on the judiciary that I think are making them feel more vulnerable. And I think what we need to do in terms of updating the system here would be to try to protect the judiciary and the judges in ways that would make it, I think, wrong to harass and intimidate them for the very decisions that they're issuing impartially.
Yeah, but you can't just accept the things that are going on right now in silence. You know, we are seeing our democracy attacked and dismantled in front of our eyes. And if you can't lead a demonstration, you know, in front of somebody's home for destroying your country, I don't know what hope is left. You know, we have to be able to speak out and be heard. And maybe feared as well, because there are no leaders anywhere that did not fear the public. And I think the public needs to speak in a louder tone of voice. We are seeing rights taken away. We're seeing fear and racism and sexism, homophobia, you name it. It's all out there, and it's being ready to be used in round two of this nightmare. So people need to voice their opinions and know that their opinions matter. And not be fooled by what you see on social media, because social media may seem like an overwhelming force of opinion, but it could be artificial intelligence. It could be people who are nowhere near this country even. It could be somebody saying the same thing 40,000 times with different names. It is not the same thing as actual people speaking out in person and making their voices heard, making their voices loud, because I don't know. Maybe I'm just losing patience in my age, but I just feel like we've been way too quiet, way too patient, and it's time that we hear a different point of view.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that we curtail the First Amendment or the freedom of assembly or speech in
not
any
at
way.
All. Nope.
No, certainly not. But I do think that there is basically starting from on high here, starting with Trump, you have this example of deriding judges and their staff and in particular their law clerks in such a public and shameful manner that they become the subject of intense harassment. And it's that type of activity that I think is absolutely wrong. And we need to protect the judiciary from in many ways, because they're the ones that are ultimately protecting us and our rights. And if they cannot issue unpopular decisions without fear of being harassed or stalked or hurt physically in some way, we've got problems here.
Well, I think we have problems on many sides of this. And it's something that, as you say, is quite relevant to our community. Any community this is relevant to, because the very future of our freedom is at stake here. And as hackers, we know how easily that can all vanish.
Yeah, I think the import of technology as an accelerant combined with how broken our system is for so many people across the myriad cross sections of our country, it pushes people into a position where they're out of time. It's too late for a system we tend to slow cook. You know, we like to let things go very slowly and go through all of this wonderful process of deliberation and legal process. Fascinating. It's quaint, but unfortunately, I'm curious, will it be able to satiate people that are on across all of that, just sort of out of time and out of patience, right? You know, if it is so broken and it takes, you know, it takes just all of this sort of self-involvement and an endless process, you get people at sort of their sort of at wit's end, right, with the process. And when that takes hold for something that is the actual place where this stuff is sorted, it I think becomes a lot more of a untenable situation, right? You get people acting out, you know, like really voicing and trying to work around that system, because it is, like Alex sort of suggested, protecting itself, you know, perpetually for just more process.
Go ahead, Alex.
Now, another point here too, and I think it dovetails with Carl is saying is, when we're talking about judges here, right? You know, the big difference in the system that was that the founding fathers had designed here to be insulated from the political process, namely the federal judiciary and these lifetime appointments, is totally different than what happens at the state level. And for a lot of our listeners that may be overseas, it should come hopefully as some surprise to learn that at the state level, a lot of the judges that preside over cases, over trials, in fact, are elected. They're on political ballots. You know, they run with a party, and you select them in local elections. And so you would expect them to be a bit more beholden to certain policies and procedures. You would expect maybe, you know, Republican candidates to be tougher on crime and various things, and Democrats to be a little bit more lenient, et cetera. But every judge is supposed to be impartial. But the reason why the federal judiciary has these lifetime appointments is to be in very stark contrast to what happens at the state level, where the judges are political animals by their very nature. And it's a crazy system that we have now, where very often it seems like it's the state court judges, the ones that are beholden to political wills of people, that tend to be more impartial than even the Supreme Court of the United States. That's a really, really sad state of affairs.
What a time. What a time to be around. I have something that might even top some of what we're talking about. A bizarre data point for this growing movement. I don't know if you know about this movement, but there's a movement to keep rap lyrics out of the courtroom. Hot Boys rapper Christopher B.G. Dorsey was recently ordered to provide the government with a copy of any song he writes moving forward, ahead of its release or promotion. He's currently on supervised release from prison for a 14-year gun-related sentence he received back in 2012. And now, according to a federal judge, the government has the right to determine if his future work is inconsistent with his goals of rehabilitation, and if so, move to toughen the terms of his release. The judge, Obama appointed, by the way, Susie Morgan, refused prosecutors' request to prohibit BG from promoting and glorifying future gun violence slash murder in his songs and concerts entirely, saying that restriction could violate his constitutional right to free speech. But this particular condition that he has to submit his writings to the government for approval before they can be released based on his history, that just strikes me as so Orwellian and scary. And I think it's not getting the attention that it deserves. This is something that everybody should see the threat of. We're talking about, you know, people writing fiction, writing something that comes from their imagination. And to say that, well, because you have a history in this particular field, you're not allowed to talk about that. You're not allowed to fantasize about that. Now, you know, there are instances where lyrics in a song are confessions of the sort, and that's a totally different matter. If somebody's stupid enough to confess to an actual crime in a song of theirs, then you have the evidence you need right there. But to tell somebody they're not allowed to express themselves artistically and creatively, that should really bother everybody. Am I wrong on this? Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, as someone who does creative work and puts it out there, you know, the fact, you know, I know nothing about this artist or his work, but I know that any sort of oversight of the things I were allowed to create would be devastating. I mean, I can, you know, I don't necessarily want to go out and write a story about, you know, murder or whatever, but I should be allowed to. And, you know, the fact that you're creating some work of fiction should not, you know, figure in any way toward whether or not you're considered rehabilitated of doing bad things in real life.
True. And by the way, you might know his work, the hit Bling Bling from 1999. No? Okay.
Oh, well, that BG.
Part of a New Orleans-based Hot Boys group, which also includes Lil Wayne, Juvenile, and Turk. They have not been active since BG's arrest, but a reunion is in the works, I hear. So there's also the concern of convicted felons performing on stage together, which violates probation in some cases. That I'm not going to speak to. I don't know what the rules and regulations are there. But if you're sharing a stage with somebody, not exactly sure you're hanging out with them, but I guess it's kind of hard to, you know, join forces in a song without having a conversation. Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, this is really crazy in many ways. I didn't know about this at all until you brought it up. But it sounds a lot to me like this is a prior restraint on the freedom of speech. This is something that the government is saying you need to submit this ahead of time and get our approval before it's published in some way or another. And anybody can see it. And this is directly affecting his freedom of speech. And anytime you're implicating a fundamental right like this, you have to think the government has to make sure that it's narrowly tailored, right? That you are affecting a right and or curtailing a right in the least restrictive way possible. So I don't think that this would survive that type of scrutiny. It's called strict scrutiny.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, especially these days. Look, if you have parents, think about them for a second. Think about how they would react to this kind of a story where some guy who sings rap music was in prison and is singing about murder and violence and all that kind of. Don't you think you have to control that somehow? Don't you think it's gone far enough? It's not hard to make that argument to people and to get them to agree to something that on the face of it, they would say, oh, this goes against everything that this country stands for. But when you inject a little fear and misunderstanding and generalizations, you can easily get people to believe this is right.
Well, it's also in the context of his supervised release, right? So I think that that must play a very, very large role in the legal analysis here, because the assumption there is that he's not necessarily in full possession of his liberty at this particular point. He's on, quote-unquote, supervised release. So the government still has some level of control or an interest in exercising control over this particular person, whether that level of control extends to the ability to control this person's First Amendment rights and curtail and then approve what this person has written and intends to speak about. I think that's an entirely different story. And I think perhaps you're right, Emmanuel, in that you could convince your grandpas and grandmas that this may be a good idea. But again, it goes back to the nature of the federal judiciary here. We're talking about federal judges who are supposed to uphold the constitutional principles embodied in the First Amendment. And I think this restriction is really offensive to it.
Well, you know, we know many people who have been subject to supervised release, and we've seen all kinds of restrictions, some of which, were unheard of at the time, such as not being allowed to use the internet, not being allowed to use a cell phone, things like that. At the time, I know we argued this interferes with someone's right to free speech. And now, that kind of thing, it can happen, and it's almost considered normal. I'm not saying it happens a lot, but it does happen. So I just think, the more you chisel away at it, the easier it gets to do this kind of thing in the future. That's why I think people need to pay attention to the cases they may not quite identify with, but which represent incursions into the freedom we all take for granted. Some more news. The Virginia Department of Elections database may have been hacked, according to RHC Dark Lab, which apparently is a news source on Google News now. A serious security incident appears to have hit the Virginia Department of Elections, causing the unauthorized dissemination of a large election database. The attack, claimed by a user known as Intel Broker, was made public through an online forum dedicated to data breaches. The Virginia Department of Elections is the body responsible for administering elections in the state of Virginia. I don't think we needed that sentence. This department ensures that all elections are conducted fairly, transparently, and in compliance with state and federal laws. It oversees voter registration, supervises local and state elections, and maintains the integrity of the electoral process through secure data management. I don't know about that part. Maybe not. Currently, this organization, RHC Dark Lab, cannot precisely confirm the accuracy of the reported breach, as they have not yet, the organization, Virginia Department of Elections, has not issued an official press release. Therefore, this news should be considered as an intelligence source. And according to reports, this compromised database contained detailed information about electoral candidates. Intel Broker, the user who claimed responsibility for the attack, stated that the database had previously been sold on the forum. However, they decided to make it public to prevent further fraud by new accounts that could have taken advantage of this information. Enough said about all that. But basically what we're looking at here, they print the fields. They call 65,000 rows of data, details such as candidate name, total votes, party affiliation, write-in vote, locality code, locality name, precinct ID, precinct name, district ID, district type, district name, office ID, office title, election ID, election type, election date, election name, and number of seats. There is nothing in here that is not public information that I can see, unless something is missing from here. When I first saw this story, I assumed it was the database of voters that was leaked. It doesn't even seem to have been that. It just seems to have been a listing of candidates, how many votes they got, from what precincts and what localities. All of this information is something that is reported after every election and is accessible. So I'm not really sure, maybe this isn't a complete story, but even if it were the database of voters in the state of Virginia, even that is public. Actually, I have to confess, I'm not sure what the laws of Virginia are. I know here in New York, it's simple to get the voter registration list. You find out everybody's name, everybody's address, everybody's party affiliation, their date of birth, a lot of information, but it's all open to the public. Now, some states have different rules. Some states don't make it accessible. Some states charge a fortune for it. But Most states, it's not hard, and many states, it's completely free, and some even have it posted online. So it's easy to get some concern with a story like this. It's easy to make people panic. But, you know, this doesn't even appear to be the voter database. It appears to be a list of candidates in Virginia. I don't know. No big deal to me. Go ahead, Alex.
This is such a ridiculous story. If it's really just those fields and we're talking about public data...
I know you're not calling Google News ridiculous because they forwarded this to the very front of their news feed. They're not people. I know they're just, you know, machines doing this, but still, these machines know what they're doing.
Well, somebody gave those machines instructions at some point, and that they must be ridiculous themselves. But it goes to my point here, which is that this is such a non-story. But if such a non-story can make it to the front of Google News like this, most people are not going to investigate the story like we're doing right now and look at the actual fields that are part of this breach and come to the reasonable conclusion that this is absurd and is really nothing. And because of that, it's this. What I find most dreadful about this whole idea is that it's the story itself that can damage the electoral process. It's the story itself, this non-story about mm-hmm. a breach that should not have been a story in the first place, that can cause distrust in the electoral system and can eradicate essentially public confidence and our willingness to even trust our data with local precincts.
Bingo. Bingo, you got it. That's exactly the point. That's exactly it. This kind of a story makes it seem as if everything is insecure, everything can be compromised, our votes mean absolutely nothing, and it's really, really scary to have something like that spread around. Go ahead, Rob, and then Gila.
Yeah, this is, I think the real hack here would be, if, you know, assuming this story is accurate, the real hack would be some outfit somewhere getting a bunch of publicly available data together, packaging it up like a leaked database, and then selling it on dark web forums for money. I mean, that would be kind of amazing. It reminds me a bit of when a while back someone started a parody sort of scaremongering campaign about a chemical that's in all your child's foods called dihydrogen monoxide. And, you know, talking about it, you know, so many foods contain it and there's tons of it in your children's bodies. And of course, what they're talking about is just water, but they package it up like something scary and put it in a scaremongering format. And people like who don't know better would hear this and think there's something terribly wrong.
Speaking of things that are terribly wrong. So we did find the original link to this article, which is on one site and we can't find it anywhere else. Literally, it's in one place. And it turns out that this is a bunch of random people from Italy who, like, a blog. This is a blog of random people from Italy. And nothing about this is good. The whole idea that, you know, the person who claimed responsibility is like, I'm putting this out so that nobody else... There's nothing... Like, I'm not saying anything that everybody else hasn't already said... But just the fact that Google News pushed this up, SEO and Google Translate could be very, very dangerous tools.
Yes.
And I think as we get closer to November, it behooves all of us as an informed voter populace to be really, really careful what we're reading, what we're believing, what we're trusting.
Yes, exactly. Rob, what was that ingredient you said was in our children's food? I'm very concerned about that.
Dihydrogen monoxide. It's right. Scary stuff if you look into it.
It really is. You know, it reminds me of when I was in grade school and people would come up to you and say, hey, your epidermis is showing. which, you know, kudos to kids for knowing what that was or not knowing what that was, but that simply means skin. Okay, well, this story, let's focus on corporate America and how they're constantly making the world a worse place. Paramount, you're going to be hearing a lot about them in the future. They basically just erased 20-plus years of news archives. All that's left is a placeholder site for reality shows. MTV News was online it's not online anymore. It's basically just discarded because they're moving on. They're forming new alliances, new companies, new programming. And just some of these comments are really heartbreaking. http://mtvnews.com no longer exists, said one of the writers, Patrick Hoskin. 8 years of my life are gone without a trace, all because it didn't fit some executives' bottom lines. Infuriating is too small a word. Mitchell Clark wrote, I don't even have the words. I was just a freelancer, but I put so much blood, sweat, and tears into telling stories that I cared about the right way on that platform. What a gut punch. As Paramount destroyed the library of articles, some writers managed to save a few for the WaybackMachine.com, archive.org, which was just profiled for trying to hold on to evaporating information on the Internet. But a lot is lost, and a lot of people won't find it there. A lot of people won't know where to look. We have to help them find that. We also have to come up with a better way of preserving the data that's out there and never trust it to these large corporations because they don't care. We've seen it so many times where you pour your life into some particular application or system that you believe in, and they decide they're just going to sunset it, in their words. And doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you put into it. It all gets erased. It all gets wiped away. GeoCities, Google Wave. What, there's so many we could list. We could go on for an hour about this. And if you don't save something yourself, if you don't have a duplicate of what it is you're contributing to, then you don't really own it. It's not really yours. And it's subject to the whims of these people who just care about profit. Huh?
I just want to say, like, it is great that there are organizations out there that are willing to do this. And I think parts of what was taken down are already being processed. And I think some of it is now searchable from the MTV News archives through the Wayback and other libraries. But it should not be. I mean, it's an indication, or it's like a symptom of how broken this is. Like, this idea that you can be sort of lulled into thinking that this stuff will last just because of a stalwart brand existing. That's not the case. And it is something that we talk about in parallel when we're talking about cloud computing, because a lot of people push for that, but this could just as easily be a part of their infrastructure that's lost or breached or, you know, falls by the wayside. There are plenty of drawbacks to storing things and archiving things yourself. It takes work, it takes planning, mm-hmm. It takes power, right? But you do get the upshot, which is you're the ultimate say as far as what the final end of life for some of this is, and you can make sure that it's sort of shepherded on in ways that make sense, not this sort of crass, just destructive ending of sites.
No, we've seen this many times before. I know BBC destroyed a whole lot of programming back in the 60s, and so much was lost just because they needed more tape or film or something. And the reasons are always something that turn out to be ridiculous in the end, and what's lost is irreplaceable. So, you know, when people like us who like to save everything and archive everything see a story like this, we feel a little bit of vindication about maybe we're not wasting our entire lives by doing this, but also anger because so many people are just creative people who don't think about, okay, how do I preserve this? And, you know, they trust the system. And this is to let you know that that system cannot be trusted. We need a better system of snapshotting internet sites so that when somebody decides to pull the plug, they're still there someplace and your work is not forgotten or disappeared. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, we're now generations into this media environment of the web in which a lot of people make, their livings full or in part by creating content, writing articles, putting up art, whatever, and they put it up somewhere else and just expect it to be okay. And, you know, we have seen so many times you know, within recent memory of, say, a news site or something just getting bought by the wrong person or just falling off the web because it ran out of money or something, and people lose their entire portfolios because they were just trusting that material to just remain available. And especially on something like the web where, you know, you have a juggernaut like Paramount, and they run all these sites, and it wasn't just MTV. There was scads of material from Comedy Central, old Daily Show episodes, historical material there, and things like that that were just lost. And, you know, hard drive space is not that expensive in the technical scheme of things. You know, they could always... The BBC has sections of its site where if you look up old articles from, say, the early 2000s, the material will still be there. There'll just be a little banner on top saying this is very old material. Don't mistake it for something new, things to that effect. And it serves the historical purpose of keeping the article up there, but also lets you know that, you know, you're not looking at the current stuff. And I think that's a great solution for this sort of thing.
Yeah. And also, you know, to not go hyperlink crazy and have links in all your content, because guaranteed those links are not going to work after 5 or 10 years. I see that all the time. When researching things, we need a better way of archiving the information that we reference as well. Otherwise, it's completely useless. We just have a bunch of outdated links. Go ahead, Alex.
This is just so sad in so many ways. I think another layer of this, too, that I think is missing from most of the reporting that I've read on it is that we don't think about this in the context of the future. We only think about it in the context of the past. And I think that the future of reporting is going to be a lot different than the past reporting we've seen, because all future reporting and all types of articles and content is going to be done with the assistance of artificial intelligence. All of these news stories from MTV, content from TV Land. This is all stuff that human beings created in the 80s and the 90s, and is a historical record of what life was like, what music was like, and all coming straight out of the brain of a human being. This is a really interesting data set about really critical and pivotal times in the United States and elsewhere. So I think that we're all missing out on what could be, I think, a really interesting historical archive and a great data set from which a lot of insight could be drawn if it were available to researchers and others. But the reason for pulling this doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me either. Perhaps what Paramount is doing is some kind of play. They seem to be saying, well, if we can't make money if we can't be profitable by making this available, then it's not going to be available to anyone.
Yeah. They don't see the value in it. They don't see that it does anything for anybody. And no doubt they have copies themselves. They probably have the entire site preserved offline. So, you know, my ask to them is to give that to somebody who will maintain it so that it can be preserved. It costs you nothing to do that.
Apparently the Internet Archive has made some kind of massive database of searchable articles that from MTV that go back. I don't think it's the entirety of it, but every time this happens, you can't expect the Internet Archive to come to the rescue. No. And store and warehouse and identify and find all of this data and keep it for historical records for mankind. That's not tenable.
Okay, a couple of letters. oth@2600.com is our email address. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Here's one letter. Honestly, you of all people, oh boy, letters that start this way. You of all people know better than to store a lot of data on your phone, because if you're arrested when you cross the border, a lot of it can be held against you. I believe this is in reference to our conversation about cell phones filling up and having to be copied over to other sites and things like that. Well, first of all, there's some assumptions here that I'm not sure hold. The writer's assuming that sensitive information is part of that. Phones are phones. We use them as we see fit. And if we want to fill them up with videos and pictures, that's all right, or music. And to assume that we're somehow falling down on the job because we have a phone that got full, the story is that these phones are being sold with limited amounts of space, and customers aren't necessarily being informed of that when they get the phones, because apparently SIM cards and expandable drives and cards are not a thing anymore. And when you have a phone, you have a certain amount of storage space, and you're supposed to use the cloud after that. And, of course, we resist that. Now, this letter continues. Set up your own private cloud or SFTP service so you can access your own data privately across the internet on demand and not keep it on your mobile phone. Okay, so I love being told what to do in simple form when it's not a simple thing at all. I would like to know, you know, show us some services that provide this, that are trustworthy, that you control yourself, because it's a great idea. It's but you just can't bark out an order to somebody and tell them to do something a certain way without telling them what that way is. And yeah, this is the solution for people to have their own private clouds that they control. But I don't know. Are any of us aware of such systems that exist? You're raising your hand, Alex. Go ahead.
Yeah, in defense of the letter writer here, I think he's right. I think it's a great idea. It's not for everybody, but there are these private clouds that exist. There's things like Nextcloud. I used to use that quite a bit. But you know, for normal everyday people, yeah, it might be a little over the top. But for instance, if you are going to a country that might be interested in trade secrets that your company is holding, and you don't necessarily want to have them on your phone, or you think you might be stopped at a border for some particular reason, I think the writer is absolutely right to try to create some kind of gateway or barrier between you as a physical person and your data. Mm-hmm. I think that point is really well received.
We make the same point. I that's not what I'm disputing here. It's just the assumptions that we're being careless, or that the solution is simple, and we should all take advantage of it. I want the solution to be simple. I want to have this system where we can tell people, use this. No corporation is going to have any control. You're not going to have to pay them to maintain your data. That's what I want. And if you give me more information about this, we'll talk about it in weeks ahead.
All right.
I guess that's about it for us for now. We will continue this conversation on Overtime in just a couple of minutes, 8 o'clock on YouTube. Just go to channel 2600. I believe, Rob, there are 2600 meetings this Friday coming up?
There are indeed 2600 meetings happening all over the world. You can find one near you. You can start one near you. The local one has information at a site called nyc2600.net.
Okay, and these are hacker gatherings where people just gather in a food court somewhere, trade information, get to know each other, and have a great deal of fun. That's what it's all about. We will see you in 3 weeks here on WBAI, and please support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. See you in 3. Good night.
Bye. Vinyloos. All you fascists are Vinyloos. You fascists are Vinyloos. Fascists are about to lose.